Hello, and welcome to Rational Security, the He Said, She Said edition. I am Shane Harris of the Daily Beast, joined here in the Rational Security studio with my friend Ben Wittes. Hello, Ben, you're back.
I'm back.
You're back and feeling good?
Yeah.
Feeling rational?
Feeling rational.
Yeah.
And secure.
And very secure.
Yeah.
We're glad that you're here. And we're also joined this week by our good friend Cody Poplin of Lawfare. Hey, Cody.
Hey, Shane. How's it going?
Good. How are you? Cody, this is your first time on the podcast.
It is my inaugural experience.
Cody has been dragooned into being on the podcast this week.
From writing the news to talking about it.
About 4 minutes ago, I walked into Cody's office and said, do you want to be on Rational Security this week? And he said, and I said, of course you do.
Of course
you
do. Of course.
And so here he is.
But Cody, you've been like a behind-the-scenes force on Rational Security for quite some time. Like, you like have frequently stepped in as our engineer when we needed one. Because I don't know how to run any of the equipment that's actually sitting in front of us right now. That's usually Ben's job.
Well, Cody is the Lawfare jack of all trades.
That's true.
And with the imminent departure of Wells Bennett, is going to step in as our acting managing editor, for some period of time until we, wave the magic wand and hire Wells's permanent replacement. So lots of things that, Rational Security listeners and Lawfare readers, experience are actually made possible by Cody
this
Poplin.
This should be called the
This
the
is
Cody
too
Cody.
Kind. Yeah.
Wow.
There
Cody's
you go.
Cody's taken over. He's taken things
the
over.
The Cody Coup edition.
Exactly. All right. This week on the show, has the Obama administration outplayed Xi Jinping and China on cyber spying? The Taliban is on the march in Afghanistan. What does this mean for the future of U.S. troops in that country? And the new movie Sicario is one of the sharpest criticisms yet of the war on drugs. Plus, in our object lessons, we'll have some other... I was going to talk about Sicario, but we're going to talk about some other things in our object lessons.
Godzilla.
We could talk about Godzilla. No, I actually have... I'm going to be pulling something from the archives for object lessons, which is going to be a lot of fun. Okay, let's start. Ben, why don't you start with our wordplay? He said, she said. We've said a lot of things on cyberspying. She has said some things on cyberspying.
Yeah, well, so it turns out this week, or last week... President Obama said that there shouldn't be cyber espionage for stealing of trade secrets and economic advantage. That's what he said. And she also said that there shouldn't be cyber espionage for purpose of stealing trade secrets and economic advantage. And this is, at least a rhetorical bit of a coup for the Obama administration that he and she are both saying the same thing. Now, Jim Lewis, who is a China cyber guy at CSIS.
One of the best.
Gave a, I thought, really interesting interview, to Stuart Baker over at the Steptoe Cyber Law podcast, which I really encourage, listeners, to, spend, half an hour listening to. And he had what I thought was a quite counterintuitive, but very intriguing and maybe persuasive case that this was not simply a rhetorical win for the Obama administration, that it was really a substantial policy victory and outmaneuvering on a bunch of different fronts of the Chinese, and represents a real win. And so his argument, which I think will be surprising to a lot of people who have heard you and me ridicule the sanctions threats, won't scratch our heads about the usefulness of indictments of Chinese officials, PLA officials, who you can't get your hands on to prosecute. Lewis's analysis was, first of all, that the Obama administration had won big in this negotiation with China. Secondly, that it is a real sea change for the Chinese to say publicly, and for Xi Jinping specifically to say publicly, what he said about, cyber espionage and trade secrets, that represents, a major policy statement for the Chinese government that sets up, you know, substantial follow-up opportunities for the United States. And third, and I thought most sort of surprising about it, was that the indictments had humiliated the People's Liberation Army and were taken extremely seriously by the Chinese and were a big part of what led to this change on the part of the Chinese. And furthermore, that the Chinese do not really understand the difference between sanctions and indictments. And therefore, the threat of sanctions was very compelling as a sort of possible further humiliation, and that this really led to a successful negotiation in which, you know, the Chinese sort of, you know, adopted a substantively different position than they previously had. So I thought this was a, it was a very interesting discussion between him and Stewart, who is, as listeners to that podcast know, not all that sympathetic to the idea of, you know, negotiating with the Chinese over norms. And it was a, I thought, a pretty interesting discussion. And I thought Lewis made a pretty persuasive case that more had gone on in, and the Chinese had given more ground than many American commentators, including us, had had allowed for.
I find that that third part of that most fascinating too, because it suggests, I guess, what he's arguing is that we viewed entirely wrong the way that these lawsuits and perhaps even the threat of sanctions are perceived. Because from our perspective, we look at this and we think these are just feckless, useless, symbolic things that aren't going to do any real damage, and the Chinese must be laughing to themselves at how weak we are and how we tie ourselves up in knots just to do something as meaningless as these five indictments. But so what is the idea that behind the humiliation, like humiliated in front of whom?
Yeah. Is this partially about saving face, I guess, amongst other agencies in China?
Well, so, I mean, I think the argument is that the People's Liberation Army was singled out, was caught, and this was humiliating.
Maybe both, their tradecraft isn't that good.
Both externally and internally with respect to their relationships with other agencies. And that
and their photographs were in that indictment.
Yeah. I mean, they were called out.
Yeah.
And, that this involved something of a loss of prestige. And there was a lot of fear of further activity in this regard, of which sanctions was considered sort of the dangling threat, and that this provoked a very significant negotiation. Now, I'm not putting my own weight behind this analysis. I don't purport to know enough about Chinese, you know, bureaucracy and agency culture, or for that matter, about, you know, what the internal reaction to any of these things was. But I do note that Jim Lewis is a very serious guy, and I think the argument is worth taking seriously.
I wonder if he is correct. If we do operate under that assumption, how does it affect, you know, kind of the interactions going forward from here?
Well, a way to answer that might be what the interactions were right up to the announcement. And one thing I thought was interesting was this Chinese official, Meng, who is sort of he's basically the equivalent of the Secretary of Defense, came over for this previously unannounced and not revealed until he left, intense four-day set of meetings, mostly around cyber, but also around maritime security issues. And my understanding from talking to folks who are familiar with that visit is that it was in large part to come over and try to head off an attempt by the administration to issue sanctions ahead of Xi's visit, which we all assumed, like, we would never do that. That would be indecorous or undiplomatic. The Chinese apparently thought we might actually do it and came over to try and settle something. We also were pressuring Xi to say what he said at that press conference. I was told by one person close to the administration, if he doesn't acknowledge cyber spying as being wrong for economic purposes, that means the administration lost something. He actually acknowledged it. So I wonder if maybe what this means is now the Chinese, we have their attention.
Right.
And that we basically have said to them, this is how the relationship is going to be going forward, is that you're going to start giving more things that we want. And if you don't, these are the sticks that we're going to use against you.
So that is certainly the implication of the argument that he made. And I think if you take it seriously, it suggests that the United States has a great deal more leverage in that conversation than our often hand-wringing on the China cyber-spying front would lead you to think. And I think that's a sort of optimistic view, a note that's, worth taking account of.
You know what's also interesting, and I never thought of it this way because, again, I've sort of had my lens has been very much through the indictments are meaningless. Can you imagine what would have happened in our military bureaucracy if the Chinese indicted, like, five senior but publicly unknown officials and implicated them in intelligence operations, and in the course of doing it revealed their targets and their tradecraft and all of these kinds of, I mean, we would be losing our shit over that. And saying, oh my God, the Chinese have figured this out, and they're telling the world how we did it.
Right. So, the other interesting dimension of this is that, he does suggest that there is a confluence of interests between the United States and Xi Jinping in the internal bureaucratic battles with the People's Liberation Army. That specifically, the PLA uses the tradecraft spying, or the trade secret spying as a way of funding businesses.
Right.
And this is a sort of sidelight thing that, it's an army, but it's also a holding company, and they steal secrets to support their
companies.
Xi Jinping wants a more professional, more modern army, and modern armies, professionalized armies, don't run corporate conglomerates.
They're not cartels.
Right? They're not cartels. And so I think the other component of this analysis that I thought was really interesting was this idea that maybe Xi's modernization of the military will have the effect of pushing it not out of the espionage business, because of course militaries do that sort of thing, but out of the money pocketing kind of espionage.
And he has gone after PLA officials
in the anti-corruption context.
And what's notable is part of this agreement, too, the cyber agreement that we reached with China, is we've created this senior level kind of standing committee that's going to meet, I think, every 6 months.
From which the PLA is not part.
Correct. They are not a part of it, which is telling. I mean, now, I think we begin to wonder, are they not a part of it because Xi Jinping said, you're not going to be at this table? You will not be here. But Cody, real quick, talk about a little bit about the issue with the Spratly Islands.
Yeah, so
because this factors into all of this too.
So this weekend, Dan DeLuce over at Foreign Policy released a piece quoting U.S. senior defense officials saying that they would be conducting freedom of navigation exercises, close to within the 12-mile radius of artificial islands in the Spratly Island chains.
12 miles being once you cross 12, you're in their waters versus
exactly.
International.
Yeah, well, at least that's the claim the Chinese are making. And I wonder how much of this is also part of the Obama administration turning to, to being a bit more proactive on some of these issues or using more measures to bring attention to them. I'm not sure.
It's always been the U.S. position that these are international waters,
right.
And it's the Chinese position that anything within, 12 miles of poured concrete anywhere in that sea that's, within what they call the nine-dash line is their territorial waters. And this is just somebody's got to lose this fight, and it's an important thing for the U.S. to remind the Chinese that we don't accept those territorial claims.
Well,
it's an important signal to send to, our partner governments in the region, particularly the Philippines.
I think beyond being expansive, the claims are also quite novel too, and that it includes an exclusive economic zone, and in that exclusive economic zone, the Chinese have a right to say that U.S. military vessels can't enter.
Right.
Which is, you know, has a huge impact on our ability to shape regional events and assure, you know, our allies. So maybe it's a really positive step.
Okay, so we'll go to my wordplay. From one subject where it seems like the Obama administration's foreign policy is going pretty well to one where maybe not so much. The Taliban has seized control, well, it's seized mostly control, we think, or at least is threatening to take almost all of it, of the northern Afghanistan city of Kunduz. Residents of nearby towns are fleeing. This is a big deal in large part because the Taliban did not have a stronghold in that part of the country, and Kunduz is a big city. It's not just some small place, and it sort of strategically is important because it is on a major road going into Kabul. So I guess the immediate question of this, and we should add also, of course, over the weekend, U.S. airstrikes apparently were targeting Taliban militants believed to be in the vicinity of a Doctors Without Border hospital and bombed the hospital and killed.
Oops.
Yeah. Big problem. A lot of questions right now still. Obama talked about this. He gave his condolences. There's a DOD investigation. He's not said what happened, if we were guilty or not. But obviously this is going to be a huge issue, complicating going from, you know, the whole question of what is the future of our troop presence in Afghanistan. The Washington Post is reporting this morning, we're recording this on a Monday morning actually, that the president is weighing a plan to keep as many as 5,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan beyond 2016. So I guess like my question for both you guys is, you know, A, does the fact that the Taliban has now, you know, I don't know if you say resurged, but sort of proven itself to be stronger and more capable than we thought, what does that do to the long-term presence of troops in the country? We have about 9,600 right now. And B, like, what do you make of the fact that, you know, in Iraq, we had no military presence, and we left behind an Iraqi army that was supposed to defend itself, and ISIS comes and takes over towns in Iraq, Mosul, and other key towns. In Afghanistan, we do still have a troop presence there, but again, the Afghan army could not protect itself. I mean, how much, I guess, my question too is, does the presence of U.S. troops in a country really matter? And in order to actually, you know, just having them there, it seems to me, does not guarantee at all that you will be able to protect key cities and territories from insurgents and militants and people that you don't like, that really it's about whether you have them in a combat role.
Right. So I think one of the questions about Afghanistan is what the objective is, right? So if the objective is to keep a relatively stable government in Kabul that controls as much territory as it can. I'm not sure how much, you know, more than U.S. support it will take to do that. I think there's, reason to think that the Kabul government is a sustainable project if you have very low ambitions for it. I think the harder question is, if the goal is to make that government actually capable of ruling the entire country without a shadow government, you know, terrorizing the people, I'm not sure we've been able to do that with large numbers of U.S. troops there.
Right.
And certainly since we, certainly the Taliban has proved quite able, not merely of frustrating that, but of, you know, sort of like really minimizing the effectiveness of that government in, you know, governing outside of, you know, a few major population centers. And I don't know what the value of the marginal U.S. troop is in that calculation. I mean, you know, I think one of the questions has to be, what's the strategic goal of the underlying Afghan policy? Is it merely to keep that government sort of formally there and ruling major population centers, and kind of open for business with the outside world? Or is the goal really in the longer term to consolidate that government as the sort of long-term, you know, governance of Afghanistan? And, my suspicion is would have to keep a fair number of U.S. troops there to have any hope in the longer project. And Iraq is a cautionary tale in, in that, certainly the Maliki government was better positioned than the Afghan government was to be sustainable in the absence of U.S. troops. And both for reasons of its own ineptitude and malfeasance, and because it was relatively weakly knit together, it did not function that way in practice. And I think there's not a lot of reason to assume that without a lot of ongoing help from the United States, the Afghan government will be, you know, significantly more effective than that. But that's, you know, just my, you know, just a guess.
Cody, what do you make of it?
I think I have two thoughts on it. The first is, I look at it and I wonder why, once again we see U.S. trained troops or U.S. backed troops being unable to take, clear, and hold territory. And what do we make of that, and exactly how embedded are we going to need to be across, you know, the region, to be able to clamp down?
Maybe they did not take to the training. Do you know what I mean?
It's a great question. I mean, you're providing all of this material.
How well have you trained them?
and a senior Afghan government official commented that the problem is that they didn't have enough resources. But when you've provided all of this support, you provided billions of dollars in military aid
and our special
and
forces
training.
Did respond at the airport too to try and help, you know, fend off this.
Exactly, how far can you go? There's certainly a decreasing marginal benefit on U.S. troop presence, but I don't know exactly how and what direction you need to shift the calculus. The other thing I question is, or I think about is, how big of a boon is this to Mullah Mansour, the new leader of the Taliban, to be able to claim that he's been in power for, just a couple of months, huge, leadership crisis.
Of course, he's also been in power for the 2 years before that.
Sure.
Just nobody knew.
Well, perhaps, yeah. But even so, now to be able to signal kind of across the globe that not only have I taken power and asserted control, but I have at least claimed for a weekend, for a 3-day, 4-day period, a city and taken it from the U.S.-backed government.
Which his predecessor never did.
Right. Right. Which no one has done except for the Islamic State since the 9/11.
So now the Taliban is
resurgent.
Well, no, and pursuing a policy of clear and hold.
Right. And also,
and why are they able to do so and the Afghan government isn't?
Yeah.
Well, and interestingly, and coming in, the Taliban coming in and mounting something of a PR offensive too. I mean, some of the reporting on this was that they came in and said, essentially, it's okay, we're the kindler, gentler Taliban, and we're not going to do some of the things we did before, preceded by some reports to go ahead and, do them anyway and start killing government and police officials. But I think, it makes me wonder whether they're taking a lesson out of ISIS here and saying, you have to kind of mount a public relations strategy and assert yourself, as this kind of governing authority. And look, we're going to make things better for you. To the extent that they're doing that, and at the same time, we're accidentally bombing a hospital. It's sure making things go. They're having a very good weekend, I guess, is how.
Right. I mean, and merely provoking a U.S. attack that happened to hit a hospital is, in the world of the Taliban, that's a great coup.
Yeah.
Right.
Anytime you can get the U.S. to kill civilians in a hospital, you've done a good day's work.
Is there, were there rumblings over the weekend, that I read this right, of people in Doctors Without Borders suggesting that it could have been a criminal act? I mean, calling it potentially a war crime?
Yes.
Yes.
Is there any validity to that?
Well, so, I mean, you are obligated under the laws of war to, to make reasonable efforts to discriminate between civilians and lawful targets. And so to the extent that the commander, didn't take reasonable steps to do that, that could be a war crime. Yeah, I think the likelihood that when you investigate this, what you're going to find is that somebody said, oh, a hospital, let's bomb it, is, right, quite close to zero. Sure. And I'm quite certain that what we'll find out is that this is in the Department of Tragic Accident, where, and the question will be, is it tragic accident of a type that involved a major league screw up, or is it a type that involved faulty intelligence? You know, that we don't know. But it's certainly true that if you intentionally targeted civilians, or if you recklessly bombed something knowing that they were there, yeah, that is a war crime.
Right.
So it's, but I think the idea that that this incident was a war crime rather than, you know, an unfortunate tragedy is probably very small.
And will the DoD investigate it with an eye towards answering that question, or?
DoD is remarkably good about doing serious after-action reports in situations like this. Now, there are certainly times when, you know, people don't believe the results that they come up with and believe that they're inflected by self-protection. But my impression is that they, you know, really don't want to be hitting civilians, and they, when something goes wrong like this, they're pretty good about figuring out what happened and, you know, how things went wrong. And I have no prospective reason to say, you know, we shouldn't let a DOD after action investigation go forward and, you know, see what it comes up with.
All right, so we'll report back on that. Okay, so our last wordplay, switching gears a little bit. Although
Shane went to the movies.
I went to the movies. And there is actually a weird Afghanistan connection to this. So I saw this new movie, the new movie Sicario, which some people may be familiar with. This is Benicio del Toro, Josh Brolin, and Emily Blunt. An unusual role for Emily Blunt to be playing a FBI hostage negotiator tactics SWAT team person. But basically, this movie is, so it sort of presents as this movie about the U.S. fighting drug cartels in Mexico, and in particular, right across the border in Juarez. And what you really find out as this goes along, you follow this FBI agent, played by Emily Blunt, is that there is this larger sort of U.S. government-backed conspiracy to essentially launch kind of like a shadow war on the drug cartels in Mexico. And it takes, you know, halfway through the movie before you figure out what's really happening, because you're sort of seeing it from her perspective. And it's beautifully shot. It's, you know, chillingly edited. The music is really creepy. It's exceptionally violent. Hmm. So if you're like not into violent films, I do not recommend this. There's a lot of special forces guys who served in Afghanistan on the team. There's like this shadowy Mexican, maybe Colombian guy played by Benicio del Toro. Sicario in Mexico, by the way, refers to a hitman. So that kind of tells you something about where this is going. But what I really loved about it was two things. Was one, it's a really smart critique of the war on drugs without being a screed. So it's not like, if you guys saw the movie Traffic that Steven Soderbergh did, which was sort of this like collection of three or four different plot lines, all of which were meant to be this like very direct kind of critique about the war on drugs is failing, you know, it's not preventing the kinds of crimes and terrible outcomes in the United States that it means to. It followed like Michael Douglas, I think, played a senator and his daughter is hooked on heroin, this kind of thing. This is more sort of like the dark side of the war on drugs and what it does to us if we're really going to try and fight it. So the premise of this movie is that this task force has basically been assembled to, you know, apparently under the auspices of a covert CIA finding, do awful, awful things to the Mexican drug cartel that we would never allow our law enforcement agencies to do. And it smacks of sort of that Taxi to the Dark Side kind of idea of the war on terror, of we're going to start doing things we would never do. And it really points out a lot of the futility of the drug war, I think. And I think that listeners of the podcast will also appreciate that while the situation sort of seems, you know, maybe a bit fantastical, all of the sort of bureaucratic underpinnings, which they actually spend a fair amount of time talking about, of the ways that this program actually works, are totally plausible.
So what's an example of that?
So Emily Blunt, I'm spoiling some of this too, so if you don't want to know, just kind of, you know, tune out for a second or fast forward. But Emily Blunt does not know why she's been selected to go onto this task force. And she doesn't even know who these people are. Like, she thinks maybe they're DOD, maybe they're CIA. What is this weird Colombian guy doing here? He won't tell anybody who he is. Why are we saying that we're flying down to El Paso, but actually we're going into Juarez? Does Washington know where I am? And she's kind of put there, she thinks, because she is this, you know, kind of go get him hard charger, you know, idealistic agent. And it turns out, like, no, she's just there to, like, hang an FBI stamp on what is actually a CIA operation so they can operate on American soil. And it's like, oh, I see. It's like this little bureaucratic trick. And she's just there to basically put the imprimatur of law enforcement on a special forces
operation. She's there to dip the sheep.
Exactly. Yeah. She's there to dip the sheep. Totally. And I was just so impressed by that. And you know, it probably was a point of the plot that was lost on 98% of the audience and is not essential to your appreciation of the movie. But I was sitting there halfway through with a friend of mine, and I said, oh, I know why she's there. And I say, she's just there to bless the operation. And of course, that's...
So here's my question. What do we know about the history of drug or war on drug as opposed to war on terror, oriented findings and covert actions?
This is exactly what I was thinking as I'm watching this film, right? So, I guess the answer is no idea, and I'll bet you there is something there. Because I was afterwards, I was having a drink with my friend who saw the movie, and I said, you know, I can remember in the transition between the end of the Bush administration and Obama, Mike Hayden going around and talking publicly and privately as the CIA director at the time, that he'd given Obama a top 10 list of threats to the United States. And that somewhere, you know, around the middle was the threat that violence in Juarez and in Mexico from the drug trade would spill over into the United States. And that he needed to treat the drug cartels as basically, you know, a national security threat to the United States. Well, that didn't happen, right? I mean, it didn't, the violence that he predicted didn't happen, and it just made me wonder, like, so has there been something going on all this time?
So it's interesting. It's a theme in fiction, in spy fiction thrillers for a long time. I forget which Tom Clancy movie it is, Clear and Present Danger. Right, where there's a series of presidential findings.
They use the Iran-Contra model.
Right, authorizing the targeting of Colombian cartels. But it's an interesting question, the answer to which I have no idea. Has there ever been? I mean, there's certainly been, you know, CIA activity, which would suggest that there are some underlying findings. But it'd be really, so if any readers, listeners know about what findings there have ever been on cartels and authorizing what sort of activity, let us know.
Call me.
Yeah, tweet at us about it.
You're aware of a covert finding against the Sinaloa
No,
cartel.
Some of them, you know, from the 80s, we may know about by now.
It could. I mean,
I'm not, you know, not still classified stuff, but.
But it was totally plausible, this idea that, you know, we would, being all out of options from the sort of, you know, the normal law enforcement kind of, you know, perspective, that this is the route we might have to go. And she, as she gets pulled deeper into the plot, you know, her, you know, faith in the system starts to erode, of course, because this is all off the books. But that Josh Brolin has this sort of great line when he's finally trying to, like, you know, force her to just accept that this is what we have to do. As he said, you know, basically, until 20% of the U.S. public decides to stop snorting or smoking this crap, we have to live like wolves. This is how we live now. And it's really dark and deep and utterly plausible to me.
Well, Shane, who does not live like a wolf, I will go see it.
Go see it.
Sounds like a great...
Definitely check it out. Yeah. All right, let's move on to object lessons. Ben, do you have your object?
I thought to myself last week, you know, as we were awaiting the East Coast's annihilation by Hurricane Joaquin, why am I so confident that this is not going to happen? And I even tweeted that that Joaquin was going to be a total bust. It was just going to be rain in D.C., just like all the other big storms have been. And, you know, we always get riled up about the killer storm that's coming toward D.C. It never actually arrives. So on this beautiful sunny Monday, having been proven right, I think back to an awesome, awesome YouTube video of a weather report that explains exactly why we did not experience this global superstorm. And here is the relevant part. We will post the whole thing on our show page because it really is a thing of beauty. But the relevant part sounds like this.
And ahead of this, a global superstorm developing off towards the Atlantic Ocean. This thing is headed our way, but the key to the forecast, right before this thing makes landfall, it is going to be deflected by Godzilla. Now, a lot can change between now and then. We're looking at the latest data. We'll continue to bring you the very latest. I do want to encourage you, though.
That is why we were saved from Joaquin. And, you know, you didn't notice him, but Godzilla was there care of us.
He was there taking care of our security. That's a totally rational thought.
Yeah, it's totally rational.
Totally rational.
The full video, as I say, is really, really worth watching.
That's great. Okay, so my object this week, listeners of the podcast will know that I have, over the past several months, sort of been going through old military records for my grandfather, and I'm trying to, like, mount a project to find people who may have known him and this kind of thing. It inspired me to go on Ancestry.com. Have you guys ever gone on Ancestry.com?
I've been on Genie.
A Genie? Is that like a rival to Ancestry?
Genealogy, yeah.
It's a genealogy website, yeah.
Well, Ancestry.com, like, the NSA basically needs to buy Ancestry.com. Because this is seriously, I was, within an hour, basically, I found, like, my great-great-grandfather. I found relatives I never knew I had, all these kind of things. And I found my great-grandfather, not my grandfather, but my great-grandfather, his father-in-law's draft registration card for World War I.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. So it looks like this.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it. That's the actual card. I have no idea how Ancestry.com has this. They probably got it from the Mormons or somebody who collects records, you know, like this. I have no idea, like, but they have this, and it's kind of astonishing that there you can, like, there it is. That's, like, my grandfather's signing up, and I think it's a date of birth, 1889, and I'm looking on here. I don't immediately see, oh, here it is, 1917, June 5th. So this would have been, wait, when was the armistice?
Late in the war.
Right.
Yeah.
Very late in the war. So he had to sign up. He was 27 years old at the time. I don't know why he signed up at this time versus any other. But, you know, there he is, like, listing. He actually lists his home address, the YMCA in North Yakima, Washington. I don't know if he was kicked out of his house or that's just where he signed up. But, yeah, there you go. Like, wow, an unbelievably just sort of unexpected piece of history.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
that's great. A World War I draft card records. And apparently he had to fill one out for World War II as well, but he was not a fighting age when the Second World War came around. So there you go. So
the Shane family, the warlike Harris family,
yes,
history continues.
Exactly. I want to find out that I'm related to some kind of, like, you know, Colombian hitman.
I think you should find out that you're related to, you know, Patton.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That would be great.
Because it really, you know, then we could have George C. Scott play you.
Totally. Then I can make all kinds of outrageous claims to know a thing or two.
Right.
About security. All right, so that brings us to the end of the show. Rational Security is a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can find links to our other show pages and our podcasts at spaghettionthewallproductions.com. You can follow us, Rational Security, at RATL Security on Twitter. Whenever you download the podcast from iTunes or your favorite podcasting app, please remember to leave a rating and a comment. That really helps us out a lot. And let your friends know about their podcast. Shamelessly tweet at them, post it on Facebook, and let us know about any topics that you'd like us to maybe cover in the future or movies you'd like me to go see.
It's all about the movies.
Yeah, or if you're Raytheon, you know, send me a missile. And
we'll review it.
Yeah, we still haven't heard a word from Raytheon.
Yeah, we have not heard a word from Raytheon.
I think we should, like, move on to promoting Harry's Razors.
That's right. Harry's Razors, if you're out there, please call.
They do send samples.
They do send samples.
Yeah. We'll take samples. We'll take sponsorship.
I love Harry's Razors. I use them already.
Do you really?
Yeah, they're great.
Really? We should talk about Harry's Razors then next episode.
I have strong opinions on that too. So.
Do you really? Okay.
All right, next week we are going to have a debate on Harry's Razors. Exactly. Maybe we'll have a chess block
debate on Harry's Razors. The show is edited by Jen Powell. Our music was performed this week.
Raytheon and the Harry's Razors.
And the Harry's Razors Jug Band. I was going to say our music was performed this week by Cindy Lauper and the She Boppers.
Excellent.
Remember Shebop?
No.
Oh, man, you don't remember that song?
No.
All right, that may be my second object lesson. I'm just going to put the video for Shebop.
All right.
Now, of course, our music was performed, as always, by Sophia Yan, who is closer than any of us in proximity to Xi Jinping.
That's true.
And
actually, Sophia is formally under the sovereign territory of Xi Jinping.
That's what she said.
That's
absolutely. All right. On behalf of my friends Ben Wittes and our special guest Cody Poplin, thanks for being here, Cody.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Shane Harris, and we will talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.